Macro Voices is pleased to bring you this encore presentation of an interview which originally aired in full color video on Real Vision Television at an earlier date. Real Vision is a paid subscription video on demand channel for finance. In partnership with Real Vision Television, we are pleased to offer Macro Voices subscribers a free trial subscription to Real Vision. To sign up, go to realvisiontv.com/discount/Macro Voices. Macro Voices does not receive any commission or other compensation if you purchase a Real Vision subscription. We are proud to promote Real Vision because we believe they are the only other financial media outlet that shares our values and standards in financial journalism.
This is Aaron Chan of Macro Voices. For this week's Real Vision Television Encore presentation, we are thrilled to share an interview which was originally published on October 18, 2015, between Raul Powell of Real Vision and Dr. Brett Steenbarger, Clinical Associate Professor of Psychiatry and Behavioral Science at State University of New York Upstate Medical University. Dr. Steenbarger joins Real Vision for a discussion on the psychology of trading and ways to analyze patterns in your own investing in order to improve performance. Through a fascinating 40 minutes, Brett dives deep into patterns of losing trades, overconfidence in high conviction theses, and importance of incorporating divergent information into your investing. Thanks again for listening, and don't forget to take advantage of an exclusive 10% discount on RVTV subscriptions by signing up at realvisiontv.com/discount/macrovoices.
Brett, lovely to meet you, and thank you very much for coming to see us.
Well, thanks for having me.
Introduce yourself and give us a bit of background, what you do and how you came into the business.
I'm a psychologist by training and worked for 19 years full-time teaching in a medical school and working as a student counselor for medical students and residents. I became interested in financial markets even before that, so that was always a parallel interest. And around the year 2000, I decided to put those two interests together, working with high-performance individuals along with the interest in the financial markets. Wrote my first book, The Psychology of Trading. A firm in Chicago became interested in the book, brought me on board to work with their traders, and I went there full-time, left the academic world to join the real world of traders in the futures markets. That evolved into work with investment banks and hedge funds. I ended up joining a hedge fund full-time in 2010. And so in recent years, have been working full-time with portfolio managers and traders in financial markets, helping them improve their performance.
So when you moved into the trading side of things, did you find you had a lot applicable from the past? Because people almost think that traders are a unique universe in themselves and the financial markets are unique. Did you find it's not? It's a broader part of the whole psychological process?
It's a very good question. And actually, it was not a large leap. And that's what attracted me. Because in both cases, whether I'm working with a surgery resident or I'm working with a global macro portfolio manager, I'm working with someone who is talented, who is motivated, who has a lot of stress and demands placed upon them, and who is trying to perform at their best. So the principles of performance and the principles of applying psychology to becoming the best we can be were really similar in the domains. So I found it to be less of a leap than it might seem to be on the surface.
Yeah, I've also heard people going across from working with world-class sportsmen also moving across to the financial markets because they found it's a similar kind of performance element.
There definitely are overlaps in terms of performance and the dynamics of what leads to good performance. The challenging part is getting up to speed with what the portfolio managers and traders are doing. Because if you don't have some content expertise, if you don't really understand what they're doing, it's hard to give the detailed feedback that would really improve their performance in that marginal degree of improvement.
Yes, because also that will give them the excuse to say, well, he doesn't understand what I do, and therefore, how can he advise me?
And that often is not just an excuse, that's a legitimate concern. So for instance, I have quite a background in psychology, but if I attempted to coach an ice skater, well, what do I know about ice skating? Any advice I would give them would be generic. So unless I've been there, done that in some way and understand the specifics of performance, I don't think anyone in my situation can be as effective as they could be.
No, that's true. So how do you, let's talk through your process. If a hedge fund says, listen, we need some help here. We need to get our portfolio managers to understand what they're doing and think about how they go through their processes. So how, what's your process in that?
The first step, as in the medical world, is to diagnose, is to figure out what are the issues. Sometimes there are psychological issues that filter into trading and portfolio management that color decision-making and lead to poorer performance. Other times there is poor trading that ends up frustrating people because of the poor results and that leads to psychological issues. Now, in both cases, there can be a circularity, but I think it's an important distinction. Is this fundamentally a set of psychological problems impairing trading, or are these trading issues, are these issues of portfolio management that are ending up impacting the psyche? Many times it's the latter and not the former.
So how do you firstly assess what is the root cause? Because I guess it makes the assumption that each trader is capable of doing their job well, but something is holding them back.
Correct. And at the firms where I work, these are very established firms. At most of the firms, the minimum portfolio size of a manager is going to be a couple hundred million with 5 years or more of experience. So these are not novices. So I do start with a prior that these are talented individuals who were recruited for a reason. Their performance is poor. I need to figure out with them why that might be. If it's a psychological problem primarily, then it won't be domain specific. In other words, the psychological problem should show up in other areas of their life. It could show up in their personal relationships. It could show up in how they deal with other interests that they have. So if you saw mood problems, anxiety or depression, that show up while trading, but then show up at other times in their personal life, then you start to think, well, the trading is not unique to this. This is a more general problem than something specific to the work they're doing, managing money. On the other hand, if you see that the issues are domain specific, that in most of their life they're functioning quite well, in the past they've functioned quite well, but in certain trading situations, certain situations with financial markets, they're falling apart, so to speak, then you start thinking, perhaps this is a problem with markets and with trading those markets that's having a psychological fallout. So a great example would be when financial markets change regimes. Suddenly, volatility changes, suddenly trend behavior changes, and the trader, the portfolio manager, has trouble adapting to those changes. And they start losing money, they become frustrated, and that impairs their later decision making. It's primarily a trading problem. It's primarily a problem in the financial markets, failing to identify and adapt to regime shifts. That would be an example of the latter.
Yes, I mean, I remember that happening to myself very much so. It's particularly hard, I find, coming out of a recessionary period.
Right.
And then trying to make the adjustments. So 2003, maybe 2004 was a difficult year for me, 2009.
That makes perfect sense.
Because it's a huge regime shift and you have to get your mind around it and then you just get settled in.
That's right. And in equities, 2001, 2002, and the first part of 2003 were all risk off bear periods. And suddenly we came out of that and people had trouble shifting their mindset.
So how do you diagnose these problems? And what are the I presume there's a lot of repeat patterns amongst different people with the same problem.
There are repeat patterns among traders and then within a given trader. And so you are looking for patterns. One of the things that I'm most concerned with that I recently wrote a book about, Trading Psychology 2.0, is the importance of diagnosing strengths as well as weaknesses. It turns out in recent psychological research that peak performance is a function of the degree to which we can access signature strengths, the things that we do superlatively well. Shoring up our weaknesses is necessary for good performance, but not sufficient. So in diagnosing, it's not just looking at the negative side of what they're doing, it's also reverse engineering the best of what they do and helping them become more consistent with what they do well.
Can you give me an example of that kind of how that works?
Yes. So let's say we're taking a look at the winning trades and losing trades for a given manager over a period of time. And we look trade by trade by trade by trade to try to distinguish what are the patterns that characterize the losing trades versus the winning trades. And what we find out, and this is an actual example from a recent situation I encountered, the losing trades were entered primarily on strength, if it was a long position, or on weakness, if it was a short position. In other words, they were entering the market being long the factor of momentum. Their winning trades, on the other hand, they were waiting for pullbacks in an uptrend and bounces in a downtrend. They were executing counter trend even when they were trying to ride a trend. Just that difference accounted for a significant amount of the profitability of their trading. Because markets were in a regime where there was short-term mean reversion, when they were entering the markets on strength or weakness to ride a trend, they would get the short-term mean reversion, they'd go in the hole quickly, and they were prudent managers, so they would stop out of the position right away, and they would lose, and they would lose, and they would lose, and they would become frustrated. So it took looking at their worst trading and their best trading, their losing trades, their winning trades, to see this pattern and to then help them crystallize some best practices. What are you doing in the current market regimes that is making money for you? What's amazing to me, and it's in the research, is the relative blind spots that people have to their strengths. When I have a trader keep a journal, what do they write in their journal? They're writing everything they've done wrong, how they messed up this trade and they lost this opportunity. And very rarely do they write about what they've done well.
Because there's that weird psychology in trading, which is the losses are 10 times more painful than the gains.
And there's good research, as you know. Yeah, absolutely. There's good research on that. And that's absolutely true. And yet the gains are every bit as informative as losses. And yet people don't focus on those. And so they never truly understand the drivers of their success.
And that's fascinating, because if you think of someone like Stan Druckenmiller,
yes,
you know, one, he's a person who knows what he does well. And he says, you know, there's the time to be a pig.
Yes.
And that's when I'll be, you know, that's when he goes for the trade.
Yes.
That's interesting, because there's a lot of other people who always talk about stop losses and how not to lose money, as opposed to how to make money.
Well, the example of Druckenmiller is a great one, because he is absolutely right in describing one of his strengths. And yet there are other money managers who, when they trade like a pig, they end up getting slaughtered. And it shows how people are wired differently and have really different signature strengths. With one group of portfolio managers, we took a look at their P&L, the profitability of their trades, as a function of their risk-taking. So, and we put it into quartiles, into four buckets, from the lowest risk-taking to the highest risk-taking. And these are talented portfolio managers, and in the lowest risk-taking bucket, they made money. And the next lowest, they made money. At the top risk-taking bucket, they consistently lost money. The opposite of Druckenmiller, because when they had the highest conviction is when they had the most overconfidence.
Yeah.
And so Druckenmiller's strength is being able to distinguish psychologically conviction from overconfidence. Most portfolio managers cannot do that. And so their strengths end up being different and they end up not doing well as pigs.
And so if you were to give somebody a tip on how to get over that, you know, what's hubris and what is, you know, true confidence in what you're doing, correct confidence, how can somebody identify that? Or is that experience?
Well, experience helps. And painful experience is sometimes the best teacher if we can survive in the P&L. But there are ways of doing that. So for instance, here's a little exercise that I've done with portfolio managers. At the time you plan your trade, particularly if it's a high confidence idea, in advance, you have to map out the criteria that would tell you that this trade is wrong, that you're in the wrong trade, that your idea is wrong. So what would you have to see in price behavior? What would you have to see in new data being released? What would you have to see in terms of central bank actions or speeches? What would tell you that the world has sufficiently changed that your idea is wrong? So you are structuring the counterfactual look. You're getting people to look at not what they have great confidence in, but what would they need to see to take their confidence down. Just being mindful of those criteria and planning around those helps people be more cognitively flexible so that they don't get locked in wrong positions when their size is the largest.
Do you find that people who use technical analysis tend to have a slight advantage in their understanding of the psychology of how they trade just because it's kind of laid out for you, entry, exit points, where you're wrong, where you're right? Does that help, or do you not find it makes a difference?
It's a good question. The term technical analysis covers a lot of practices which range from evidence-based ones to sheer voodoo. And so it's hard to lump it all together. I would say that technical analysis, when used with a degree of rigor and perhaps even backtesting, can be very useful because it provides a system, so to speak, or a language for framing hypotheses. I personally, both in my own trading and in working with traders, like to think of technical factors as hypotheses rather than as conclusions. And so it's a way of framing your thinking. But then the important part is testing those hypotheses and being open to the market's eventual test of those hypotheses.
Thinking back about what traders do, what are the other obvious things that people don't understand? I mean, journaling is a really great idea because I think it helps you identify, and particularly if you're not in a big hedge fund with huge systems understanding every trade entry. But what are the main things that people should look out for in their trading to understand where things are going wrong or where they're going right?
Well, I think the first part is keeping score. You can't really reverse engineer your strengths. You can't really diagnose your problems unless you're keeping score and seeing where the best trading is occurring and where the worst trading is occurring. And most traders look at their P&L, but they're not keeping score in a process-based way. So for instance, with the portfolio managers I work with, we break down trading into component processes. One of those processes is gathering information, research. Who do we take information from? Where do we get it from? What do we read? Who do we talk to? That's all information gathering and research. The second process is idea generation, generating ideas from this massive information that we're taking in. That's really the creative process of trading. Once we generate the idea, the third component area is trade expression. How do we express that idea that we've just generated? Do we express it using an option structure? Do we express it with an outright position or maybe a relative trade? How do, you know, with this asset or that asset? So we find the optimal expressions to optimize our risk reward. Once we have the optimal expression, the fourth part is managing the risk of the trade and managing the position as it evolves with time, including the exit. And finally, there's self-management. How do we manage ourselves so that we stay in a peak performance mode? Those are five different facets of trading, and ideally, we should be in touch with our best practices in each of those five areas. If you don't know your best practices for research, or if you don't know your best practices for risk management, how can you stay grounded in best performance?
Yeah, in my experience, there's a lot of traders out there who never particularly do well in their careers because they do just that. It's a very scattergunned approach. They kind of get research and they'll implement a trade without having done any homework.
Right.
They will not think about all the various factors involved in that decision-making process and expression of the trade. And you realize it's obviously sloppy is what it becomes. And so the results don't come through.
Yes, it's not really approached as a performance activity. I'm going to be doing my talk for the Stocktoberfest group. And you know, one of the things that I'll mention there, and I mentioned in a recent Forbes blog piece, is that there is an immutable law of performance, peak performance. And that is the elite performer always spends more time and effort preparing for the performance than actually engaging in the competitive performance. So if you think of the Olympic athlete, if you think of the chess grandmaster, they spend much more time studying, preparing, practicing, drilling than actually competing in formal tournament play. With traders and portfolio managers, that's not always the case. And so if they're not spending quality time practicing, drilling, building skills, building strengths, then that catches up with them in terms of their performance.
And how do you avoid trade paralysis then? Because sometimes people who are not used to doing so much work on their trades start doing that, and then before they know, they've got all of the do's and don'ts or the pros and cons all stacked up in front of them and they can't make a decision. It stops people trading to some respect.
Yes, and it's a very good point. And so what you do in preparation is very different than what you would do during the performance. So for instance, let's say you have a police SWAT team and they are practicing again and again and again and again, breaking and entering a room where there is a suspected felon. And so they will practice and drill different scenarios and where that person might be in the room, how many hostages they might be holding, what you would do if they had a weapon. You would drill that and drill that and drill that until it becomes relatively automatic. You want the preparation to build skills at a level where you can implement them and not be paralyzed by the analysis process. So the whole key to training is making skills routine through repetition.
And what are the simple skills that people should look to do to get, you know, simple best practices that they should do? I know it varies on the individual and the situation that they're in, but is there any simple kind of guidelines you say, you know, most people should do this and it will help tremendously?
And again, it does depend on the style of trading, but in terms of the traders I work with, the best practices that they can engage in that would help them are ones related to creativity and being able to see markets through unique lenses. One of the great challenges for the hedge fund world, and I would say the money management world in general, is the high degree of correlation among markets and the resulting high correlation among portfolio managers and among portfolio management firms. So it places a premium on uniqueness of perspective, the ability to generate unique ideas. You can only do that if you expose yourself to divergent information. So a best practice is to seek out information that is relatively foreign to you or that disagrees with your pre-existing beliefs, because that will push you to look through different lenses. It's a kind of brainstorming that can lead to creative insight.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I do in my idea generation process is to not read anybody else's research.
Right.
You know, so I start the basis of an idea myself, build it myself, then get the evidence myself, and then analyze it, and then either implement or I write about it as well, because I write economic and investment strategy. So, yeah, I find that that's a much cleaner process, because I think that's one of the things that I talk about a lot is groupthink.
Yes.
How do you stop people getting involved in groupthink? For me, one of the best things I ever did was move away from London, be out of New York, and be in both Spain and the Cayman Islands, is I didn't have groupthink around me. But when I go to New York, it's so prevalent, it's extraordinary.
The groupthink is a huge issue, not only with portfolio managers and hedge funds, but I see even among day traders on the trading floor, they get excited about a particular stock, they get excited about a particular idea, and it's contagious, and soon everyone's in the same trades in the same direction, trading the same way. And so there really are two ways to approach it. One is the way that you mentioned in terms of, to some degree, walling yourself off from the herd. There's a portfolio manager I've worked with who stands on the trading floor. He has a standing desk and has headphones, the noise-canceling headphones, listens to music, and tunes out all the noise on the floor, develops his own ideas. He has a very quantitative process, and it works very well for him. There are others who take the other approach and who very consciously seek out conversations with unique people, people who have distinguished themselves from the herd. So they approach the problem of groupthink through selectivity of interaction. They tune out, but they're filtering in the divergent inputs that they find informative.
Yeah, I find that's another thing that people are not very good at is the homework element of researching their own unique ideas. And I think you're much more successful because you have some intellectual integrity if it's your own idea, because you've thought about it and looked at it.
Great point. Not only do you have more intellectual integrity, you'll have more staying power in the idea. No one is going to buy the bottom ticket and sell the top tick consistently. So you're going to have adverse price movement. What keeps you in the trade when it's moving against you, but in a way that still is consistent with random price movement? Often that confidence to stay in the trade comes from the fact that you have generated the idea, you've done the homework, you see the information, you believe in it, and so it's yours as opposed to something you simply borrowed from a sell-side piece, let's say.
So is there another way, any other ways to filter out that noise? So let's assume you've developed the idea, the markets are moving around, and there's a lot of news flow, and people are telling you one thing, telling you another thing. How do you get people to concentrate on what exactly they're trying to express in their trade?
Yes. The opposite of filtering out the noise is amplifying the signal. So there are creativity exercises that help people build their own signals. So, for example, there is an exercise in what's called brain writing. Brain writing is the written or keyboard version of brainstorming. So let's say I have looked at markets, followed markets, maybe I've talked with people about markets, I've read about markets, and at the end of gathering all my information, I start typing away everything that comes to mind about this market. Maybe I'm thinking about the US dollar, and I'm thinking about central bank policies, I'm thinking about trade and shifts in trade balances, and I'm thinking of economic indicators around the globe and how they're shifting. And I type and I type and I type, and every idea that comes into my head, positioning, sentiment, everything that comes into my head, and one idea that I type might lead to another idea, might lead to another idea. I'm doing no censoring whatsoever. I'm just typing and typing and typing until I run out of things to type or until my fingers become completely exhausted. And sure enough, I'm finding myself typing things that I hadn't been thinking about. This idea led to this idea, led to this idea, led to a new idea, just like in brainstorming among people, so that what we're doing is amplifying a signal by putting us in touch with what we know, but don't know that we know. Yeah. It's called implicit knowledge, and it's a very interesting area of psychology research, where we know something, but we can't really verbalize it. The classic example would be, we've now talked with each other for quite a few minutes, and let's say someone you knew wanted to meet me at the airport, and you had to tell them what I look like. Well, you could give them some general physical descriptors about the glasses I wear, about my height, about how handsome I am, and ultimately, they wouldn't be able to find me. If you were to go to the airport, we've interacted, seen each other, you'd identify me in a heartbeat.
Yeah.
There's visual information, a gestalt, a whole, that you can't verbalize, but which you know.
I know that intuitively because writing the research that I write about, I don't know, 80 pages a month in a one-off sitting, and I don't think about what I'm going to write until I write.
That's great.
And it's weird because sometimes I think I'm trying to second-guess myself. I start the writing process and think, oh, I'm going to be thinking this, I'm sure. And I start writing and doing my analysis, and before I know it, the whole lot comes out. It's almost like speed, like automatic writing. It comes out.
It is. And it's automatic writing. And that is part of a creativity process. I joked with my publisher when I was writing one of my earlier books that the last page I write in the book is the table of contents. Yeah. Now, if I had outlined my book in this very logical fashion, I should know everything I'm going to write and just write by that. But the book writes itself. I then go back and look at what I've written and I form the table of contents. That's much more how the creative mind
works. Yeah, that's a much more creative process. And different people are different types. And some people are much more scientific and other people are much more creative in how they approach
things. That's right. And there is a great deal of creativity within science. So you can be very structured in your inquiry, which is what scientific process is all about, and yet you can be very creative about the topics of your inquiry. And so having rigor along with creative insight, putting those together is extremely important for financial returns.
I want to move on in a second about how people need to manage their lives to manage their trading, because I think that's very interesting part that I pay a lot of attention to. But just finishing on the main trading part, what do you think is the biggest myth that gets perpetuated in the kind of rules of trading that you always see and think, oh, I wish people didn't do that?
Yeah, a lot of mainstream wisdom it's not that it's wrong, it's that it's limited in its perspective. So for instance, you'll hear people say, good traders are always disciplined. Good traders stick with their process. Well, if markets were unchanging and static, then you could find your source of edge and stick with it faithfully, and you would be profitable forever. I would like to find such a world. It's not the world that would end up employing me as a psychologist, because markets are not stable. They're not static. The time series of market returns are not stationary, which means that variance will change over time, direction will change over time. And so that it's not a matter of just finding your edge and then implementing it in this disciplined fashion. It's that we are always evolving or need to evolve new sources of edge to adapt to changing markets. That was the main reason I wrote this most recent book, The Trading Psychology 2.0, was because there were so many myths that I was seeing in The Trading Psychology 1.0. Markets change, we have to adapt. It's like the world of technology. You know this as a business person. You know, at one point in time, a technology is state of the art. BlackBerry found its edge. Now, if you just are disciplined and stick with that edge in an unceasing way, suddenly someone is coming up with an iPhone and someone is coming up with new technology and you're behind the curve. Business markets, financial markets, they evolve, and a big part of our processes has to be adaptation and figuring out how those changes are occurring and how we can profit from them.
How the life changes people should look at doing to be a better trader or to manage, I think the hardest thing is risk. I mean, people it sits very uncomfortably with people when they take risk. They don't sleep at
yes.
night. They don't.
Yes.
They get overly focused on financial markets. You know, because people start watching every tick.
Yeah.
What do people do to manage that process in their lives? How do they create their life, make their lives better to allow them to trade better?
There are a few ways, and some of them are trading ways. You know, if they have a higher degree of balance in their portfolio, more positions relatively uncorrelated, then anything going wrong in one area will be more likely to be cushioned by other areas. So portfolio construction ends up helping people sleep. That trade expression that I talked about. If you express an idea, let's say with being long some options, well, you have dedicated some premium to that idea, but that's all you can lose. And that helps some people sleep at night. There are other cases and a lot of situations where balancing the stress of trading has to be accomplished by maximizing the well-being in the remaining parts of your life. What the psychology research teaches us is that stress only becomes distress if we don't have sufficient well-being. So what is well-being? Well-being means happiness, doing things that we love doing. Happiness means life satisfaction. Are we doing the things that are intrinsically meaningful to us? Well-being is energy level. Physically, are we doing things that energize us? And the fourth area is relationships. Are we becoming closer to people, and do we derive positive experience through our relationships with others? So those are four domains in which we can very purposefully set up our experience so that we're happy, we're satisfied with what we're doing, we're energized, we're closer to people. And if markets are not behaving, it hurts and it's frustrating, but there's a balance that we experience emotionally so that the stress does not become distress.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think it's I notice a lot from people around me who just become obsessed by financial markets.
Exactly.
And then they don't hold relationships.
It's another one of the myths that the great traders are obsessed. The great traders have a passion for trading. And I've done recruitment at the hedge fund level. Whenever I see a prospective manager who says, I eat, sleep, and drink the markets, it means everything to me, I know I've got a vulnerable person on my hand. I know I'm going to be very busy. Because by definition, their energy level, their mood is going to rise and fall with P&Ls.
Yeah.
And that's a vulnerable place to be. We all draw down. We are fallible. We need to have some cushion to that. You mentioned the idea of journaling. How many people journal to maximize their positive experience in those four areas? How many people keep a calendar of their daily to-do list that includes the activities that they will engage in that maximize their happiness, their closeness in relationships, their energy level, the stuff that goes in the calendar are the to-dos. And then the personal tasks, the family things, and there's precious little time left over for maximizing well-being. And yet, if we were going to cushion the stress of trading, in some ways, those well-being activities would be the first things that would go into the calendar and then our work around it so that we're working more efficiently in a positive mode rather than inefficiently being overwhelmed.
Yeah, because the whole game, it's a game of life. It's not a game of a career or trading.
Right.
It's the game of life is the one you want to win. Right. Trading is only part of it.
Exactly. And trading fits within your life. If your life is fitting within trading, then it is controlling you. And that's a formula for distress.
So if people want to learn more about some of your things, you mentioned the book, which sounds fascinating. I'm going to buy it immediately.
Okay.
Well, it sounds really good.
So they can Google me and find out more than they would ever care to know. I write the Trader Feed blog. That's all one word, traderfeed.blogspot.com. I also write a blog for Forbes. I've written four books for Wiley related to trading psychology. The Trading Psychology 2.0 is the most recent book. And the one before that is called The Daily Trading Coach, which is really a cookbook of psychological techniques that people can use to manage themselves and their own emotional experience in markets. So those would be a few ways people could acquaint themselves with the work I do, the ideas I have. And my Twitter handle is Steenbab, S-T-E-E-N-B-A-B, and I'm pretty active in social media as well.
Great. Well, thanks very much. It was great to meet you.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.